don't care if people use birth control, for goodness sakes.
A state lawmaker defends his comments on birth control. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 24th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Alaskans remember the Exxon Valdez spill, which happened 25 years ago today.
Here, Governor, here's the cure of the spill. This product is just what you need. One guy showed up with nylon mesh bags full of chicken feathers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
In the process of declaring war on fetal alcohol syndrome, a Fairbanks state senator was labeled as an enemy in the war on women by national media outlets for comments he made about birth control. In an interview published by the Anchorage Daily News on Friday, Republican Pete Kelly said, quote, "Birth control is for people who don't necessarily want to act responsibly," unquote. The Alaska Democratic Party blasted those remarks, and the story got picked up by outlets like MSNBC and The Huffington Post. Kelly says his response was taken out of context. He believes binge drinking is irresponsible and that it can lead to a fetal alcohol case if birth control fails.
I don't care if people use birth control, for goodness sakes.
In a speech on the Senate floor today, Kelly said the group behind the Fetal Alcohol Initiative may eventually consider the role birth control may play in reducing instances of the disorder. But right now, the initiative is built around a public relations campaign and an effort to establish community responders who can help pregnant women who struggle with drinking. One idea the group is considering is supplying bars with pregnancy tests.
It's a PR weapon, clearly. If you have a bowl of, you know, a plexiglass bowl of pregnancy tests, that's an advertising exposure in and of itself.
This is the second time in 1 month that a Republican state senator has attracted national attention for statements made about birth control. Political advertisements can get mean, but two new TV spots in the race for Mark Begich's U.S. Senate seat are trying for that warm, fuzzy feeling. Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice stars in an ad for Republican challenger Dan Sullivan. The ad aims to quash the argument of a pro-Begich super PAC that Sullivan belongs more to the Beltway than to Alaska. In the ad, Rice says Sullivan is a tireless defender of the country.
Now Dan faces political attacks because he wanted his family by his side. Remember that serving our country required some time in our capital.
Sullivan was an assistant secretary of state under Rice from 2006 to 2009. The ad is from Republican super PAC American Crossroads, which spent $180,000 to air it. Crossroads says the ad is its first in a Senate primary and Rice's first endorsement of any Senate candidate. Rice is due to headline a big GOP fundraiser for House Republicans next week. Meanwhile, the Begich campaign is airing an ad showing footage of both the senator and his congressman father campaigning across Alaska by small airplane.
Mark was 10 when he lost his father.
In Alaska, bad weather again hampered.
We've lost too many Alaskans this way. But Mark is clearly his father's son. And there's nowhere he won't go to listen and stand up for Alaskans.
The race is said to be tightening. National data whiz Nate Silver says the incumbent has lost some ground, but he still favors Begich to win. A poll released today by New Jersey-based Rasmussen Reports puts Republican Mead Treadwell ahead in a matchup with Begich, but within the margin of error. In a Sullivan-Begich contest, the polling firm says voters are evenly split. The The Alaska Business Development Center spent last week coordinating free tax assistance across the state. Teams of two and three volunteers traveled to small bush communities to help residents prepare tax returns. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes traveled to the St. Lawrence Island community of Savunga to see how it works.
Bruce Merrill has lived in Alaska most of his life, and since retiring from a career spent at the Anchorage Public Library, has gone on several tax assistance trips across the state with ABDC.
I've been from Heidelberg in southeast Alaska up north through the Brooks Range to Allakaket and Anaktuvik Pass. Been Quinnahock, Tuntutuliak, Eek, Nightmute, Good News Bay, and this year I get to come to Nome and Savunga and gamble.
Two volunteers were set up at folding tables in the Savunga IRA building on St. Lawrence Island. At one point, they moved to a side room to make space for the day's elder lunch, but they gradually worked their way through a steady stream of residents eager for free help on their taxes. Merrill says he wants to help bridge taxation policies with the realities of life for many in rural Alaska.
Well, taxes in the villages can be interesting. It's not the same as in town for obvious reasons. We try to serve the people who do have wage income because often their income is low enough that they are entitled to a refund. And that's a big part of our program is getting people the refunds that they are due. So what's different in the villages, too, is a lot of the activity, of course, is subsistence related.
The walrus, whale, seal, bird, and halibut harvests, among others, are strong in Savunga and account for a lot of the food people put away and rely on for the year. Walrus ivory is also an essential resource for bridging the subsistence and cash economies, with raw tusks and carvings bringing in capital to the island. But then, is a walrus counted as taxable income? Alicia Bereni, the other volunteer on the trip, says nope.
Subsistence isn't counted. So if you're just fishing and you're just feeding your family, that quote-unquote income of food coming back to your family, but then also those expenses that you might incur from subsistence, subsistence isn't going to be counted as income.
Bereni qualifies she isn't 100% sure about the specifics of taxing expenses connected with subsistence, bullets or gasoline, for example, but it's hard to imagine there are many people with more expertise on how the tax code gets grafted onto subsistence practices. The nearest tax preparer is a plane ride away in Nome. Bereni says she had more homework prepping for this trip than any of her classes at NYU Law School, but that there were still pieces of personal finance in Savunga she found difficult to fit into tax forms.
An average person who had a 9-to-5 desk job, they might have one W-2 and maybe they have a little investment. But out here, people, you know, there's a huge problem with unemployment, and a lot of people will have one-off contracting jobs that they can get. They might do day labor or be a part-time janitor. So they're going to have a lot more documents. Usually it's more challenging when you have more paperwork.
Family life is also different in many small communities than the standard taxable unit anticipated by the Internal Revenue Service. The tax code has traditionally been structured around one or two earners in a home with a few dependents. Merrill says many of the people living in multi-generational homes in places like Savunga aren't provided with clear guidance on how to account for their dependents.
The makeup of families is often non-traditional from a tax viewpoint. It's not always a mom and dad and two kids. Very often it's an extended family that includes adopted kids or relatives or kids from outside the family. And so we try to work with the people who come to us as carefully as we can to figure out who is a dependent.
ABDC is financed through a patchwork of grants and donations, some of it coming from the state and IRS. Last year, the group helped just under 8,000 Alaska residents receive about $5.8 million in returns. This year, they have volunteers traveling to every community in the Bering Straits region, including, for the first time, Diomede. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Kodiak woman tells the story of trying to get her kids to safety during the 1964 earthquake.
They immediately jumped up, tried to get their shoes on, but they were falling all over the place, and I can't do it. I said, carry them out.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community.
Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
It's been 25 years today since the Exxon Valdez tanker ran aground, spilling hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil into Prince William Sound. Around the Capitol building, the memories for many are still fresh, as KTOO's Jeremy Shea found out.
25 years ago, Marta Lustufka saw a puzzling ill omen. She was at a party where a woman was giving readings with tarot cards.
And everybody kept getting this scary card. It was like the death card. She said, "You know, I don't know what this means, but something is going to happen that's going to affect all of you." And that was probably just a few days before the Valdez oil spill. And then we realized, oh, that was it.
The spill brought a frenzy of activity to Alaska, workers, reporters, and profiteers. Legislative aide Ron Clark had a front seat.
At the time the Exxon Valdez went aground, I was a special assistant to Governor Steve Cooper.
Clark and the governor flew up to Valdez a few days after the spill. They got off the plane, and Clark remembers the governor asking him, "Are you ready for this?"
And I said, "I don't know, what's this?" He says, "You'll see." The doors opened, and like two dozen Klieg lights flash on. All these camera lenses suddenly are trained on him. Microphones being thrust at him and people shouting questions, and he kind of pauses before he wades into this, and he turns to me and says, "That's this. This is what I meant." And he just walked into this amazing scrum of press people.
Clark says entrepreneurs came too, by the thousands, clawing for a few minutes of the governor's time to hawk their cleanup solutions.
"Here, governor, here's the cure of the spill. Here's what you need to, this product is just what you need." One guy showed up with nylon mesh bags full of chicken feathers.
It was supposed to be an alternative to oil boom. Within a few weeks, Clark remembers banker's boxes filled with spill-related mail lining the hallways of the Capitol's third floor.
You know, there was a whole section on, like, sea otters. You know, oiled sea otters, clean them and release them, kill them humanely, you know, and every category of letter had a banker's box. And we just had piles and piles and piles of these letters that just kept pouring in.
The impact wasn't so immediate for Senator Gary Stevens. He was in Kodiak at the time teaching history. There, the first weeks were part of an awful waiting game. The news reached Kodiak weeks before balls of crude oil fouled the beaches.
It was just a horrendous experience as we watched that oil over time slowly move out of Prince William Sound and eventually hit the beaches of Kodiak. We knew it was going to happen, and it's just like one of those inexorable things. You know it's going to happen, and you know it's going to happen, and finally it does.
Stevens remembers the sight of
oiled birds and the oiled animals and the oiled workers as they were out there trying to clean it up.
The workers at sea needed a way to clean themselves up, too. Representative Paul Seaton was a commercial fisherman at the time, and one of his fish tenders was repurposed for just that. He put an old house with a boiler and tanks aboard the ship. It supplied fresh water and served as a decontamination unit.
Because all these people were out there cleaning up and they had no place to take showers or wash any clothes for the first part. And so we became the vessel that was out there providing cleanup for the cleanuppers.
Clark says it was a bizarre and surreal time. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
This is an important week for anniversaries of big disasters in Alaska history. Thursday marks the 50th anniversary of the 1964 Good Friday earthquake and tsunami. The 9.2 quake took lives and destroyed houses and infrastructure in Anchorage, Valdez, Seward, and other communities. In Kodiak, at least a dozen people died in the tsunami waves that followed the earthquake. Most of the downtown area was destroyed. KMXT's Brianna Gibbs talked to two survivors about what it was like to live through that day.
My name is Esther DiNotto. I've lived in Kodiak all my life, was born and raised here, and my husband was in the service here, and I married him in 51, and we had seven children.
My name is Ivor Malutin, and I was born and raised in Kodiak. I was born in 1931. And I've been here all my life, so this is really my town.
I'm putting a pan of biscuits in the oven. I was cooking dinner. All of a sudden, everything was shaking. Things were falling, and I wasn't able to stand upright. And the kids, I hollered at the kids, "Get your shoes on, get your coats, let's get out of here, because we're having an earthquake." And sure enough, There was one daughter was in the back bedroom, and the older girl was with the boys talking and watching TV too. So anyway, they immediately jumped up, tried to get their shoes on, but they were falling all over the place. And I can't do it. I said, carry them out and grab mine too. And I had to get the baby. He was 3.5 months old.
My mother and our whole family, we thought it was the end. We were at home. My brother just filled all the glasses on the table. We were just sitting in to eat dinner, and he was filling all the glasses with water. He filled them all, and he's walking to the sink with the pitcher, and it started shaking. So immediately we ran out outside, and we lived by Cessna's Reynolds out by the Coon Field, and all the trees were just like big fishing poles, just going, making a loud noise, just back and forth like we were trying to whip a fishing pole. And the road was just rolling. And at that place, the women were outside screaming because there were Navy wives. It was in a rental unit all around our house, about 10 of them, and they were all just screaming out there. And my mother finally got them all together, calmed them all down, and told them to quit screaming. The best thing they could do is start praying. And we honestly thought it was the end of the world. That's what we thought.
And we ran out the door, and the ground was just rolling. It was like the ocean water, you know, just in waves. It was really weird to see the ground rolling like that. And we were crawling up the hill. We were going up to our neighbors right above us. They were in a trailer, and they were higher than us. So I got all the kids across, and I had to go back into the house to get the youngest daughter. And I didn't really want to go down there because the house was jumping up and down on its foundation. And then I had one big tree in the yard, and that looked like it was going to fall on the house. And I had to cross the porch, get in the house, go to the back bedroom, falling all over the place and crying. And anyway, I grabbed her and out we went.
The earthquake was so strong, I just could not believe, you know, what I was seeing. We went down to the harbor, and the harbor was just boiling, and I happened to look at the entrance over towards the San Herman Harbor, and the water on the outside outside the entrance was about 3 feet higher than the water on the inside, and it was just gushing into the channel, into the harbor, just pouring into the channel.
I got back home, my biscuits are on the ceiling, some of them. Kids are crying. While it was happening, they were hollering, make it stop, make it stop. My daughter was screaming. It was really scary, and getting, if there was a little shake afterwards, those kids were right on top of us in our bed.
Kodiak wasn't prepared, but they were prepared because the only thing that prevailed in the whole thing was, besides God helping us, was common sense. Everybody had common sense, and they were using it, and they used it extensively because that's all we ever had before. Just prior to the earthquake, the people had voted on urban renewal, believe it or not. And everything was going to be demolished downtown, even if we didn't have the earthquake, that was going to happen. And my boss was really a super good guy. I worked with him for probably 7 or 8 different jobs all over Alaska. And he advised the city council that the best thing that he could see that they could do with the city of Kodiak is to take the downtown and just to fill it in. Just get a lot of rock and put 6, 8, 10 feet, whatever you want to put in there. Cover all the old water lines, cover all the old sewers, cover everything, and start over new, because that's what you're going to have to do. That's what he said. The earthquake brought a lot of good to Kodiak, even though it brought a lot of bad.
Ivor Malutin and Esther Dinato survived the 1964 earthquake in Kodiak. They spoke with Kodiak reporter Brianna Gibbs. KMXT Kodiak will air a half-hour program with more personal accounts of the earthquake on Thursday at 12:30 p.m. You can stream the show at kmxt.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at Alaska.bp.com. Registration is open for the Alaska Trails 2014 Trails Conference, April 24th through 26th in Anchorage. Agenda and more information at alaska-trails.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Trails.
A Washington, D.C. political group is calling for the state to take criminal action against Wasilla's Republican Representative Lynn Gaddis. Melanie Sloan, executive director of the organization Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, says Gaddis took advantage of Alaska taxpayers when she accepted $65,000 from the Matanuska-Susitna Borough in a 2011 land easement deal. Sloan says her group wants action against Gaddis because
it seems that she got away with it. That's why. I suggest that both the Attorney General and the U.S. Attorney investigate whether Ms. Gaddis committed a crime by deliberately including a provision in the easement deal that would hold her harmless in case anybody came after her for the easement, which she knew perfectly well she had no right to offer.
CREW wants Alaska's U.S. Attorney and State Attorney General to launch an investigation against Lynn Gaddis and her husband Richard Gaddis for taking the money because, Sloan says, the land was not theirs in the first place.
And then as soon as somebody came after them, they said, oops, we can't do this deal, but we get to keep the $65,000 we took for doing absolutely nothing.
Sloan points out that the Gaddis' land is State of Alaska agricultural land and is under restrictions for its use. The borough wanted the easement to build a temporary road on the land, but the road plan was later dropped. Representative Gaddis says she has never attempted to hide her involvement in the easement deal.
So now we got the folks in Washington, D.C. Well, I got to tell you, keep your nose out of our business. We've already been through that. And that's why I said this is a rehash of an old project.
Gaddis says that the issue was well covered in local papers when it happened almost 3 years ago. The story broke in the local press less than a week before the 2012 state election. Gaddis won her seat regardless.
What I find specifically offensive about this CREW thing, and I won't tell you, because it's not fit for print what my husband said about it. But, you know, the words that Borough East construct a haul road and refuse to return the payment. I didn't refuse. You refuse when you've been asked. I wasn't asked to return the payment. Why? Because we did everything that the contract said we should do.
Gaddis says she has no idea why the story is being brought forward again, but she has her suspicions that it is politically motivated. Sloan says that CREW is supported by private donations, but would not divulge who the group's donors are. CREW has written to Karen Loeffler, U.S. Attorney, and State Attorney General Michael Geraghty, expressing the organization's concerns. The three-day Chumai Festival wrapped up in Sunday in Bethel. More than 20 dance groups from up and down the Yukon and Kuskokwim Rivers and across North America came together to dance, celebrate, and this year to heal. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
This is a year of healing.
Chief Acts Peter Atchak welcomed the Delta to the 2014 Chumai Festival.
If you came in here brokenhearted, or if you came in here a little bit sad or there's something bothering you, we are going to get rid of that.
The recently revived Udmouthlet group was back for the first time in 6 years. Ollie Alexi explained a crowd favorite. It's a song about the birds and the birds.
Yeah, generally that means it's a goose mating song. Mm-hmm. Boy and a girl come together, dancing together in face-to-face. And at the end, they get together and they mate.
They become
a boyfriend and girlfriend.
Alexi Brown is with the Udmouthlet group.
A lot of us go through our own problems. We have our own heartaches and struggles. Mm-hmm. And just dancing seems to, you know, take some weight off your back. You can express yourself and you can have an open mind and an open heart.
One local group making a long-awaited return to Chumai was the group from Kwikluk. They haven't performed at Chumai since 1990. Garrett Michael and Solomon Olick are from Kwikluk. Olick says it's taken some homework to bring those dances back to life.
And some of the motions were changed because we forgot it. Okay. We forgot the motions and watching the old DVD VHS tapes. We corrected our motions.
Chumai this year celebrated two men who have lived that idea of healing with dance. The festival was dedicated to the late Albert Atchak of Chivak. the living treasure was presented to 97-year-old Ben Tucker of Emongook. World-famous harmonica and fiddle duo Mike Stevens and Ray McLean put on a show. The two have performed for years at the Grand Ole Opry. Stevens is from southern Canada. He's working to combat the epidemic of huffing. Stevens has gone out and simply given harmonicas to kids with huffing problems.
You don't know where it's going to end up. You don't know what's going to happen. But it only takes that one sort of spark or inspiration to help somebody figure out what they want to do or, you know, turn a corner.
Two visual artists opened an exhibit on the healing theme. Mask maker Drew Michael is Yupik and Inupiaq. He and painter Elizabeth Ellis teamed up to make the Aggravated Organisms exhibit. The 10 masks each deal with a different disease, like diabetes, fetal alcohol syndrome, and behavioral health. Michael says masks have been traditionally used to tell stories and teach.
And so it was really important for a mask maker to be able to portray a story, dance it, and sing about it, and then share it. And then as a community, there could be kind of a prayer ceremony, and hopefully there'd be some kind of healing.
Michael then passed on the large masks to Ellis to paint.
I just kind of looked at the mask, and I just kind of got the feel of what illness or disease would kind of go with the mask. So it just got better and better, I think, as each mask was producing. So we did 10 of them. My job was to do the research and find kind of the best imagery, what would fit.
2014 marks the end of the term of the current Miss WIO and Miss Chiang Mai, Megan Leary. She handed the Miss WIO sash to, drumroll please, the 23-year-old ran on a platform of encouraging younger generations to pursue higher education while simultaneously continuing to be strong in traditional ways. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, and Ben Matheson in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.